Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
President Trump says he pulled Russian President Vladimir Putin aside at a summit in Vietnam this week to ask about Russian agents' alleged interference in U.S. elections last November. Putin reportedly denied any involvement once again, and for now, President Trump wants to quit pressing his Russian counterpart about the matter. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If Putin's denials satisfy the president for the time being, they have not been enough to end U.S. investigations into Russian meddling. The National Security Agency, the FBI, and the CIA all say Russia did engage in hacking and other tactics that seem designed to undermine U.S. confidence in the democratic process and widen political and social divisions between groups of Americans. The challenge now is twofold: figuring out exactly what happened in 2016 and determining what it will take to ensure foreign agents are unable to have an effect on future elections. Juan C. Zarate is chairman and co-founder of the Financial Integrity Network and former deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism. His article, "The Cyber Attacks on Democracy," appears in the fall issue of the Bush Institute journal, The Catalyst. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington to talk about it. Juan, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. I'm very excited to be with you, and I appreciate the time.
Wonderful. I want to go first to this phrase that you use in the piece. You describe a full-scale assault on American democracy. How much do we know about what the Russians did specifically?
I think every day we're discovering more, Chris. This is in part what makes the story so interesting and also so important to follow. I think we're learning not just about Russian intentions, which has been obviously to undermine faith and confidence in U.S. democracy, which follows the playbook that they've used in places like Eastern Europe before, but we're learning more about the means by which they did that. And it's not just the use of their classic media operations like Russia Today or Sputnik, which are relatively well known, but the use of social media and online capabilities to manipulate messages, to buy ads on Twitter and Facebook, to have bots target particular segments, and to highlight certain themes that would not only aggravate social divisions in the U.S., but also undermine faith and confidence in the government and in the system itself. And so I think what's being revealed and what I tried to talk about in the article is this wasn't just a one-off. This wasn't an attempt by the Russians to be cute in trying to manipulate the election one way or the other. This is actually part of a strategic campaign where they're using a new form of asymmetric influence and warfare to try to not only benefit Russia, but to undermine whomever they consider to be an enemy or a challenge to Putin's power. This is, as some experts call it, new generation warfare, with an attempt to use influence as opposed to arms to get at their enemies.
And from the Russian perspective, right, this is pretty low risk. It's cheap to do, and you can have people operating from far afield of any place where the U.S. has jurisdiction.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the lowest cost enterprise you could imagine in terms of economic or classic statecraft. It doesn't cost a lot of money to have hackers trying to hack. It doesn't cost a lot of money to put ads on Twitter or Facebook. It doesn't take a lot to create this sort of vicious information cycle of repeated narratives that may have a kernel of truth in them but are wrapped in conspiracy theories or falsehoods. It doesn't take a lot of money. It doesn't take a lot of people, and it's certainly much less than classic arms and classic statecraft. The other thing that they're able to do is they're able to use the information environment to their complete advantage. The fact that you have an open information environment in Western democratic systems to actually shape narratives and shape the debates. And then use tools to potentially even hack into voter rolls or to affect voting systems, which they certainly tried to do in the U.S. and have done in other places like the Ukraine. And so this is low cost, high advantage, and it plays right into something else that's important, Chris, which is it plays into the deniability that the Russians love to play with, because something that Putin has mastered is the ability of the sleight of hand here, where they demand proof, where they know it's very difficult to attribute or difficult to at least publicly demonstrate what the evidence looks like. They've done that in the context of Crimea and the Ukraine. They did it with the downing of MH17, where frankly they just stopped the UN's investigation with their vote. They've done it with the Syrian use of chemical weapons, and they've done it again with cyber attacks. Their constant refrain here is prove it. Hmm. And this is a domain where they can play in that realm of ambiguity, because it's both hard to attribute, not impossible, hard, but it's even harder for American intelligence agencies to make that proof publicly known and to explain it in its complete sort of vision of what Russia's done.
Yeah, what did intelligence and security agencies here in the U.S. have to consider before making their suspicions and discoveries public in a deeply polarizing election season?
Well, this is where we start to drift into the politics of the elections and the pre-election period. I think the intelligence community, as has been discussed by former Director of National Intelligence Clapper and former CIA Director Brennan, were raising alarm bells around what they were seeing and witnessing with respect to Russian interference. I think those leaders have said they were hoping for and wanted a more robust open discussion about this, and were met, I think, both within the White House and within the Congress with some trepidation about opening up that discussion, in part for fear of lending greater legitimacy and question to the elections as a result of what Russia was doing. So there was a little bit of a caught between a Scylla and Charybdis for the White House and policymakers. Because you do want to make the American public aware of what's happening. You want to warn, send a warning shot across the bow to the Russians. But you also don't want to undermine faith and confidence in the election itself. And so I think that was part of the challenge. And I think this is part of the new world where there was no playbook on our end as to how you actually reveal this, how you do this in the middle of an election, and how you do it in a way that preserves confidence in the system as opposed to undermines it. And so I think that's part of the ongoing debate. And certainly there's going to be different opinions as to what should have been done and what should have been said when.
Well, in a way, it makes it the perfect crime for the Russians, doesn't it? Because if we don't say anything, maybe they can continue to get away with whatever meddling they're doing, especially in these state election networks that may have been hacked. If you don't say anything, if you do announce it, then people think that it's all a mess and Americans don't trust that their votes are being properly dealt with.
Yeah, I think in part that's the brilliance of this kind of asymmetric campaign of influence. All you have to do is inject some doubt, especially on something so fundamental to democracy as the election of a president or the democratic system itself. All you have to do is inject some degree of doubt. And something I point out in the article is, the Russians, to have effect, or anybody else who's learned the lessons of this kind of a campaign, to have effect, they don't have to actually hack into every voting roll in every state. They don't have to change the numbers of who voted for whom. All they have to do is inject some degree of doubt, let's say in a crucial swing state, to have some strategic impact that, as you said earlier, Chris, is very low cost, very low risk, and if the U.S. isn't willing to push back, doesn't have much consequence.
Juan, can you say definitively that the United States does not engage in this sort of activity abroad?
I have security clearances and certainly had the highest clearances when I was in the White House and served in government. So I've got to be careful as to kind of what we talk about in terms of capabilities. But it's clear that the U.S. is not trying to undermine elections with these kinds of campaigns. Now, skeptics of the U.S., critics of the U.S., certainly the Russians themselves will say, hey, you obviously fund NGOs that are about promoting democracy. You and your diplomats sit down with opposition leaders in our elections. You provide, through the Carter Center and others, you provide, and even the Bush Institute, you provide learning and training around, democratic processes, electoral politics, campaigning, et cetera. All of that is a form of influence. And to a certain degree, they're right. We do those things. But we're not engaged in this kind of cloak and dagger, full-throated campaign to undermine elections and governments through the use of cyber tools, to include hacking, to include information warfare, and to include a whole range of steps. The U.S. has lots of tools, and frankly, we have the best tools in the world, I think, at being able to influence abroad and to affect actors abroad. But we're not trying to undermine democracies, and we're not certainly trying to use our economy or new generation warfare to undermine the credibility of governments, certainly not in Western governments. And to the extent that we've got target countries like North Korea and Iran, I think we're probably trying to do everything possible to discover where the threats are coming from. So I don't want to dismiss your question or potential criticism, but it's a very different kind of campaign than the U.S. meeting with opposition leaders or trying to promote democracy.
So, Juan, how does the Putin government use American consternation over election meddling to its his advantage domestically? Like, how does he benefit at home from reporting in Russia on turmoil in the United States?
Well, I think Putin has several goals for his government, his country, his policy. First and foremost, I think it's not just the strengthening of his hand, but the consolidation of Russian power and influence. Keep in mind that Vladimir Putin has said one of the greatest tragedies, or the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, was the fall of the Soviet Union. And in many ways, he's been trying to recast and recapture that influence, those capabilities, ever since he's taken power. And so what he gains in all this is not only the ability to be perceived to be reaching into the heart of other systems. And so you've got the British just today, Theresa May, the prime minister, speaking out against Russian efforts to influence the public debate in the UK, basically saying, we know what you're doing and we're confronting you. In France, in Germany, now questions about the next Mexican election. You know, Russia then is at the heart of these questions and issues. And in many ways, they gain greater influence as a result. In addition, to the extent that the U.S. is sort of eating its young in terms of an internal political process, you now have investigations underway with respect to Russia. All of that is a distraction for the American public, the American polity. And that gives Putin greater running room, frankly, around the world, whether it's in the context of Ukraine and his near abroad, whether it's in the context of what he's doing with Iran and Hezbollah in Syria, whether it's what he wants to do to expand his reach in parts of Asia. You know, it gives him more of an opportunity to constrain American attention and influence if, in fact, he's able to, you know, confuse us and confound us at home.
Are you fairly confident that this sort of Russian activity against the United States began with the 2016 election, or is there credible evidence that the Russians have been building within this country up to this level of interference?
Well, it's clear that the Russians have been building this playbook and these capabilities over time, and certainly not just geared at the 2016 election. This has been sort of an experiment in the making. They've been perfecting this over time, and as I mentioned, plenty of meddling in European elections of a variety of sorts, everything from classic paying political parties to cyber hacking. But 2016 was just part of that process. And frankly, I think just the tip of the iceberg at this point.
My guest is Juan Z. Zarate, chairman and co-founder of the Financial Integrity Network, former deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism. His article, The Cyber Attacks on Democracy, appears in the fall issue of the Bush Institute journal, The Catalyst. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Juan Zizzerati, who is chairman and co-founder of the Financial Integrity Network and former deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism. His article, The Cyber Attacks on Democracy, appears in the fall issue of the Bush Institute journal, The Catalyst. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. One, President Trump's most recent comments about this say that at the very least he believes that Putin believes that Russians did not try to influence the U.S. elections in any way in 2016. The president has also argued that probes into his own campaign's complicity amount to a witch hunt. Why do you think he wouldn't press for an investigation that might, in fact, clear his name of any wrongdoing or any knowledge of wrongdoing?
It's a great question, and sometimes it's hard to understand why the president sort of re-injects this issue in a way that that is unhelpful to him and to the administration. Frankly, doesn't help him in the context of relationships, the relationship with Russia. Look, you can understand that the president doesn't like the implication that it was Russian meddling that led to his election. I think there's a visceral reaction from the president to that line of argumentation, which isn't made explicitly when the Russia issue is raised, but is certainly in the backdrop. And I think that's, you know, probably first and foremost for the president. He doesn't like the challenge of legitimacy to his election. And so I think that's first and foremost. I think there's also, you know, the president is trying to say something, which I think everyone agrees with. President Obama agreed with, President Bush agreed with, which is it's better to get along with Russia than to be in at war with Russia. I mean, that's sort of a, that's a given. And I think he's trying to make that point over and over again, maybe too much so. And as a result, it ends up looking very suspicious in the context of the investigations. It looks suspicious with the drip, drip, drip of new revelations of what contact there had been with the Russians and with WikiLeaks, the news this week. And so I just think the president's instincts are a little bit rough on this. Instead of saying quite clearly, look, we need clarity, credibility, and closure on the investigations. And we need that not only to get out from under this cloud so that we can move forward, but also to understand, this is something I emphasize in the article, to understand what Russia's trying to do moving forward. Because 2016 and the investigations will not be the end of the story. This is something that CIA Director Mike Pompeo has said over and over again, that we've got to worry about what is a very different and new threat from Russia. And frankly, we've got to worry about this along with our allies around the world, some of whom may not be as able or as capable of defending themselves. Again, there was a recent article written by an expert in Latin America about the potential threat to the Mexican election, which, you know, has grave significance, not just for Mexico, but for the U.S. Obviously, listeners there in Texas are well aware of it. But in any event, I think the reality is the president wants to move away from the investigations. And the reality is we're going to have to move toward the challenge of Russia using these kinds of tools again and again.
How much evidence is there, if any, that the Russians have the ability to affect the casting and tabulation of votes, the things that are counted in, you know, counties all over the country?
Well, there's certainly no evidence that I've seen that happened in 2016. And I think this goes to some of the president's arguments, which is, look, everyone's talking about the manipulation of the election. The electoral voting was not impacted, right? That's a different question than were the Russians trying to influence? Were they trying to undermine faith and confidence in democracy? Were they trying to impact both candidates? Because I think they assumed, like everybody else, that Secretary Clinton was going to be the next president. So they were trying to muddy her, trying to weaken her hand, et cetera. So the question of whether or not the Russians are able to manipulate the actual vote count is an important one. But there is no evidence of that yet in terms of the 2016 election. I don't think that they did. And I think part of that has to do with the very nature of our electoral system. It's a federal system. The states run, states and localities run the electoral process. They aren't sort of connected centrally so that you could manipulate all 50 states at once. Many of them are still offline. Many are still paper ballot. So to do this kind of at mass scale is very difficult. That said, we do have evidence, and we've seen that the Russians were trying to get at voter rolls. They were trying to see if they could infiltrate some of the systems. And that's precisely why I say, as a key sort of response to all this, that we've got to create a defense and redundancy of the current systems that looks at the whole supply chain, that says we've got to protect the voter rolls, we've got to protect the current existing systems. Any new online systems we're creating have to have very strict firewalls and systems in place. And frankly, we may even want to ensure that we have paper ballots as backstops, and even take some systems offline if they can't be protected. And so there's no evidence that the Russians have done this yet, but it's clear that they've tried to see if they can get into the supply chain. And I think it's important to protect it, to test it before the next election.
So you estimate that there may have been 400,000 Twitter bots generated by Russian hackers. For folks who maybe don't use Twitter, can you explain what a bot is and what makes it so hard to distinguish it from a flesh and blood American user just generating content and opinions?
Right. A bot is a mechanized way of creating content that automatically creates information and in some ways has its own digital identity. And so a bot can spew out messages, can be programmed to repeat messages, can be set to actually target particular audiences. And so the bots have the potential to have exponential impact. And if you look at some of the recent data that's emerged, not only do you have the bots on the Twitter sphere, you have the ads that were bought on Facebook, and a targeting of particular segments of the U.S. market, and you've got some estimates of tweets by Russian accounts, 131,000 YouTube accounts, 80,000 plus elements of content hosted on the Russian Internet Research Agency's site, millions who witnessed and looked at ads that were bought by the Russians, and so this is significant. That let me just share this data point: an estimate of views of Russian bot tweets, what we're talking about here, over basically a 3-month period, could have totaled up to 288 million views.
Wow.
Right, so it demonstrates what these bots and the advertisements and the tweets are able to do in reaching literally millions of eyeballs and potentially affecting opinions in the United States.
So I think we understand that no one is so unsophisticated as to see something once and then suddenly be converted to that way of thinking. But if I'm scrolling around on social media and I see these messages enough, maybe I think a lot more of my friends and neighbors espouse positions that turn out to be the positions that Russia wants us to vote for. And maybe that will cause me to make a different choice in the voting booth. Is that it?
I think that's part of it. I think it's also the Russians taking advantage of narratives and messages that are already in the ether, or already on the internet, or even already being debated in society. One element of their campaign was to whip up more attention around the Black Lives Matter movement and to foment even fake protests. And so what they do is not only create new narratives or reinforce those narratives, as you were saying, as sort of an echo chamber around particular ideas or themes, but what they did in this case and what they are doing in other Western societies is to take particular issues of concern, whether it's Black Lives Matter during the last election, whether it's the refugee crisis in Germany or other issues like that, and they're reinforcing raw, difficult messages that are intended to divide the society and affect opinions. That really, to me, is one of the most revealing and dangerous parts of what we've seen, because it's not just that they're trying to impact your opinion when you pull the lever or check the box for your candidate, but they're actually trying to undermine faith and confidence in the system and to fracture it even more based on their messaging, using social media, using these bots, using Twitter accounts, using their standard media, RT, and reinforcing that echo chamber so that it begins to appear more and more prevalent and becomes something that becomes, a part of the landscape and a part of the debate.
Okay, before we go to the phones, and without getting too technical, if you would, talk a little bit about the mechanisms that security and intelligence agencies in the U.S. have to detect this sort of operation.
Well, it's a great question, because there's been an assumption for a while, which was true back several years ago, that attribution of cyber attacks or cyber infiltrations or of information campaigns was very hard, that the attribution was near impossible. We underwent probably 5-6 years ago what I would call to be an attribution revolution. That is, the ability of sophisticated actors, not just governments, but you have private sector entities like FireEye, Mandiant, CrowdStrike, Symantec, all these cybersecurity firms that are able to do the forensics around identifying particular individuals, units, entities, all the way sometimes to the actual individual. And so you've seen the U.S. government in recent years bring indictments against Chinese PLA officers because of hacking. And they could actually point to and have revealed evidence that points precisely to the individuals involved in cyber espionage or cyber hacking. And so in this case, we know that the Russian Internet Research Agency was behind a lot of these bots, behind a lot of these sites, behind the content bought and distributed on Twitter and Facebook, and videos uploaded on Google and YouTube. And you can do that with technical precision by understanding the source of the content, by dissecting the code, by looking at the methodology used. There, hackers have particular ways of doing things, and so there's often forensics around the particular individuals. And the U.S. government, as you can imagine, has other tools that they use on foreign territory against hard targets to try to identify where they are. I did a lot of work on counterterrorism in this regard, and if we were trying to find an al-Qaeda member, we try to use as many tools and techniques as possible. But this is really not just about the government. It's often the private sector that's revealing the attribution behind these attacks.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Deputy National Security Advisor for Combating Terrorism, Juan Z. Zarate. We're talking about the cyber attacks on democracy. He wrote about it for the fall issue of the Bush Institute Journal, The Catalyst. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak first with Carlos in Austin. Hey, Carlos.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I'd like to just kind of pick up on the last point that your guest made about the sort of private sector, and I'm wondering what his opinion would be on the effects sort of post-Citizen United on political action committees and the ability for the private sector in the United States or internationally, I don't know, to kind of raise funds that would then influence the elections domestically. I feel like maybe the American electoral system as the electorate is sort of an open target right now for disinformation or misinformation.
What do you think about that one?
Carlos, it's a great question. In fact, if you look at my article, the back end of it, I address this pretty specifically. I think you're right to point this out as a vulnerability, and I think you've seen Congress beginning to focus on this question in light of Russian meddling in democratic systems. You certainly have the question of funding transparency. Who's funding what? Even in a traditional campaign, who is funding the ads that you're seeing on TV? And this is an important question, because the Russians have mastered the art of using proxies, using shell companies, even the revelation of the Panama Papers of the Russians using various entities to move money around the world and to influence is important to recognize. And so we do have to take into account that we need funding transparency around who's buying ads and what they're doing and who they are as part of our defense. And certainly that's a part of the debate on Capitol Hill. There's some new legislation being discussed. And certainly Twitter and Facebook are thinking more aggressively about how they can figure out who's buying the ads that are behind some of these attacks. The other part of this equation is, how do you think about information, and how do we think about information validation? What you've had in places like the Czech Republic and Estonia have been the governments being so worried about Russian misinformation that they've set up centers to actually identify where there's misinformation and then to call it out publicly and then to push back. I'm not sure, you know, that's an American way of doing things, but as part of the ongoing debate, you do have Facebook and Twitter and Google thinking about how they validate information. This goes right to the heart of the fake news phenomenon, or at least concern. And that has to be part of this as well, because if you have opaque funding from foreign sources able to sort of seed and give life to false narratives or conspiracy theories that then impact public debates and our political structure, you know, that's really dangerous. And I think we've got to think about that. There are problems on the other side, right? We don't want Big Brother telling us what to think and do. But we do have to realize that Russia's taking advantage of the current system, and that includes the electoral system and how funding is less than transparent.
My guest is Juan Cesarotti. He is chairman and co-founder of the Financial Integrity Network and former deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism. He recently wrote an article for the fall issue of the Bush Institute journal, The Catalyst. It's called The Cyber Attacks on Democracy. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by emailing think@kera.org. You can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the former Deputy National Security Advisor for Combating Terrorism, now chairman and co-founder of the Financial Integrity Network, Juan Cesarotti. His article, The Cyber Attacks on Democracy, appears in the fall issue of the Bush Institute journal, The Catalyst. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Juan, how are we supposed to retaliate against attacks like these?
Well, that's a great question. It's one that the national security community is grappling with, not just in the context of these kinds of challenges to the U.S. electoral system or information and cyber ops against democracy, but more broadly with respect to cyber attacks. Think back to the hack of Sony by the North Koreans, where you had really for the first time a revealed attack from a nation state against a major U.S. company that not only sort of hacked their systems and got access to information, but attempted to destroy parts of their systems. And if you recall, there was a major debate at the time as to what do you do about that? Do you go to war? Is that an act of war? Is it defined as an act of war? Is it simply an act of some form of espionage and should be treated as such? Is it a form of criminality? And so should we try to indict people or investigate as a crime? Or is it more a form of hard diplomacy and need to find ways of dealing with it that way? So I think how we define these attacks and how we look at these types of vulnerabilities then begins to dictate how we think about responding. And in that Sony case, largely what we did was to rely on economic sanctions to say we're going to identify the actors or the agencies within the North Korean system that were behind this attack, and we're going to then designate them and affect them economically to the extent we can. But largely, that was the extent of it, at least to, based on what we know publicly. So in this case, I think the challenge is, what do you do to Russia to confront them? And as I say in the article, to really begin to deter them, because I think the challenge is, what do we do moving forward, not only to protect our systems, but to demonstrate to the Russians that we're going to treat this seriously. Part of this has to do with additional sanctions. Congress has already done that with respect to the cyber activities of the Russians. Part of this has to do with maybe holding certain things that Russia holds dear. For example, information, further information about Putin's inner circle, his finances, how they're operating, maybe holding that as a sort of Damocles over the Russians' heads, maybe taking a tougher line in other places like the Ukraine, perhaps a more of an open debate again about arming the Ukrainians in the context of the conflict with Russia, maybe taking a slightly harder line in places like Syria, where the Russians have doubled down in their support to Assad and Iran and Hezbollah. I think there are a range of things to think about, but I do think the one thing we need to avoid is thinking about the tit-for-tat dimension of response. Simply because the Russians have done this kind of an attack or waging this kind of a campaign against us doesn't mean it has to be the same going back. We've got lots of other tools and leverage to be able to pressure to the Russians and to demonstrate that we're serious about confronting them. That, I think, is in part why some of the things the president has said recently probably not helpful to him, because he wants to strengthen America's hand to deter Russia. And if Putin thinks that he can kind of get away with pushing the envelope here and really isn't going to be confronted, not just online, but in other ways, that then plays to Russia's interest, because they'll continue to play games, they'll continue to push the envelope. And what we're going to see is more cyber and info campaigns and attacks. Of the type that we're seeing in other countries as well.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Evan is calling from Denton. Hi, Evan.
Hi. I was wondering if you could clarify who you mean when you say Russians are meddling in the American election. I feel like making a broad statement like Russians or all of Russia might have like negative effects on American perceptions of Russians.
It's a great question. And Evan, I think you raised two important issues. One is, what do we mean by meddling in the election? And secondly, what do we mean by Russia? So let me take those two on. In terms of meddling in the last election, I think what I'm talking about and what I lay out in the article is a spectrum of things that the Russians did to try to influence at a minimum, the debate surrounding the election, during the election, and at its maximalist form, tried to actually influence the way that voters thought about the issues and about the candidates. And they used information tools, many of which we've talked about. They used cyber tools and hacking, to include the hacking of the DNC, and they played with trying to get into voter rolls and into, as I described, the supply chain of the electoral system. And so there was a whole range of things that they were doing that involved meddling. Meddling is sort of a good word because it doesn't suggest that they actually succeeded in affecting the final vote, which I think is a major debate in all of this. It also isn't so soft to say where they were just kind of issuing their own opinions on their media sites. You know, this was a very active campaign, a very aggressive campaign using a variety of tools, but they didn't ultimately change the vote counts. And so that's what I mean by meddling. When we talk about Russia here, we're talking about the leadership of Russia, the government of Russia. Two important points here. One of the most important conclusions from the intelligence community that came out about this issue was the fact that the intelligence community believes with high degree of confidence that these were decisions made at the highest levels of the Russian government. that this that President Putin was aware and was directing these issues, not necessarily directing every element of this, but he had the strategy and was directing it. That is incredibly significant, especially in light of the diplomacy that we have to do with President Putin. The second part of this is more complicated because it does implicate more of Russian society than just President Putin or his cronies around him, because the Russians have mastered the use of proxies to enable their activity. And so you do have things like the Russian Internet Research Agency, which has been a part of this. They were behind a lot of the bots and the advertisements. They obviously have Russian media that they use, which they control. And they use non-state actors, hackers, even in some cases organized criminal actors for purposes of state activity. And one recent element of this that's entered the public debate, given what the U.S. government has decided, is whether or not Kaspersky Labs, a very important a technology company that does a lot of cyber defense, your computer may even have Kaspersky software on it, that the U.S. government was no longer going to allow Kaspersky systems or software to operate on U.S. government systems, and that they were going to consider Kaspersky to be an arm of the Russian state. So part of this question that you've asked is a really important one, because the question of where does the Russian state start and stop? What are the agents and elements of Russian society or even the economy that Russia uses? What's the definition of that? And I think, Evan, to your very important question, we've got to be very clear about that. We're not talking about all Russians. We're not talking about all Russian institutions, but we're talking about a campaign led by the Russian government at its highest levels using elements of Russian society and capabilities.
So obviously election meddling is very, very serious and dangerous. A lot of people are worried about cyber attacks on infrastructure. Frankly, Juan, I worry the most about the banking and financial system. I mean, it's theoretically possible for a hack to, eliminate evidence of all of the financial structures that keep this country running.
Chris, you're near and dear to my heart on this. I've written a good deal about this as well. I had an article a couple of years ago talking about the convergence of cyber and financial warfare and the real dangers, to your point, Chris, which is the financial system's critical to our nation, to our economy, to the functioning of every element of our society, frankly. There are global dimensions of it that make it incredibly effective and efficient, but also make it vulnerable to potential hacking. And we've seen hacking at all levels, everything from low-level criminals all the way to high-end state actors, targeting the financial system largely for profit, frankly. It's where the money is, so it's where these cyber actors are attracted, but also to potentially put the financial system at risk. And what you had recently with the hacking of the Bangladesh Central Bank, the hacking of the SWIFT system. The SWIFT system is basically the bank messaging system for the global financial order. That was hacked and began to raise questions for the international community as to how secure that system is and whether or not ultimately, if you had a sophisticated enough actor, that actor could actually destroy systems and destroy data. And that really is troubling, because just as the electoral system and democratic institutions are based on trust and confidence, the banking system is as well, is based on the very notion of trust and confidence that when you put your money in your bank account, it's going to be there the next day. And if there are actors out there who can begin to fidget with that, can begin to manipulate the trust and confidence in that system, we've got a real problem on our hands. And so I agree with you, Chris. That's something to watch. It's also an area where I think we can cooperate, ironically, with the Russians and the Chinese, because these are two countries that rely on the very same systems. They're countries that don't want their stock exchanges or their major banks to be collapsed. And so I've argued that this is an arena for potential innovation and how we think about cybersecurity, at least around one set of actors or systems that everyone who's legitimate can agree we don't want to be disrupted.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back and take one more question from Andre in Dallas. Hi, Andre.
Yeah, good morning, Ms. Good afternoon, Ms. Boyd. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And that lends itself to my question regarding what's most important, national security or the profits from our capitalistic system. So the question really deeper than that, at what point do we put sanctions on U.S. companies that are illicit in this, i.e. Facebook type, such that we put sanctions on them given their participation in this process? I hear you talk about putting sanctions on Russia, but where do you weigh in on a sanction in an accomplice situation where social media companies are gaining profits?
Thanks so much for your call. That's a great question, Andre.
Andre, it's a great question, and it raises several issues. I think you know the easy initial answer is certainly any U.S. person, be a company or a citizen individual, who's colluding with, conspiring with the Russians to manipulate information, to manipulate the elections, and to do so, in violation of law, should be held accountable, and should the book should be thrown at them. You should not have people who are acting as foreign agents trying to undermine the U.S. system, first and foremost. Second is this question of should the media companies, should the tech platforms like Twitter, like Facebook, like Snapchat and others, be regulated in a more dramatic way so that they're forced to validate information, they're forced to ensure that the funding that they're getting for their advertisements are actually from legitimate actors and not in aid of a foreign power. Those debates are happening now, and I think you're likely to see more thought and perhaps even some regulation around what is required of those companies. And if they then are in violation, they should be held to account. It's very hard, though. All of this is happening in a social media environment that's evolving quickly. We take Twitter and Facebook as a given. Those didn't exist just a few years ago. And how they operate under these conditions is still a work in progress. I think it's what they're grappling with. I think it's what Congress is grappling with. Chris, if I can just raise one other issue, which Andre's question raises.
Sure, and you got 15 seconds.
Yes, the use of the economy and financial power. The U.S. has mastered this. It's part of what I did at the Treasury and at the White House. But the Russians are really good at this as well. Part of their campaign is to use their own economic and energy resources to influence. That has to be kept in mind because it's part of the equation as part of Russian power.
Juan Z. Zarate is chairman and co-founder of the Financial Integrity Network, former deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism. His article, The Cyber Attacks on Democracy, appears in the fall issue of the Bush Institute journal, The Catalyst. Juan, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast at think.kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.